good thing about search is people comfortably use it. They take it for granted. We've been answering questions for a while. But with generative AI, we can do it a lot better. We've been testing it for a while, and we now feel it's the right moment to roll it out broadly.
That was Google CEO Sundar Pichai in an interview with CNBC this week. Google announced a massive change to its search function at the company's annual developer conference in San Francisco. Now, when you type in a question on Google, the first thing that could pop up in your search results won't be a link to another website, but to an AI-generated answer or summary. This new feature is rolling out now, and it's making some people nervous. Anyone from that suburban mom with a popular recipe blog to major media outlets. Garrett DeVink is a tech reporter for The Washington Post, speaking of major media outlets, and he covers Google, AI, and all the algorithms out there ruining or running our lives. I don't know which it is. But anyway, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. All right. So search generative experience, that's what they're calling it, SGE. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, it's exactly what you said. You know, when you go onto Google, you type something in, you're going to get an AI written response. And so what it's doing is it's using a chatbot just like ChatGPT, Google's version of it. They call it Gemini. And it's going on the web. It's understanding what you're asking for. And instead of showing you those links, it goes to the actual websites. It quickly reads the websites, and then it summarizes them in sort of a multi-paragraph answer. And it will post the links to those websites that it read and summarized at the bottom of the answer. But because the box that it's showing you often has 300, 400, 500 words, for a lot of people, it may actually fully answer the question that they want, and they'll never actually click through and go to the website where the content was originally taken from.
Right. So give me an example of how that might work. Let's say I want to look up a recipe, how to make chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. I think another one, you know, a lot of people will go for DIY help. You know, maybe there's something wrong with your toilet. It's making a noise. You don't really know what that is. Before, you would type in, you know, how to fix a leaky toilet or what to do if my toilet is making a noise. And, you know, it would pop up a few different links to bloggers who are maybe handymen, people who write answers to these kinds of things and build websites and put them on there. And now it's just going to sort of give you that answer, that step-by-step, you know, guide to how to fix a leaky toilet directly in Google.
And why are they doing this? What problem needed to be fixed from their point of view?
You know, it's a great question. And I think, you know, there's a few different answers, and it sort of depends on how you view the industry, how you view Google. Google says that they're focused on the user, the person who is using Google. And for years now, they've been giving answers. You know, you can sort of argue that Google is moving towards being an answer engine instead of a search engine. So even 5, 6, 7 years ago, a lot of things, for example, you know, what time is it in London right now? Or what's the weather going to be like in my town today? It's not going to give you a website that you then have to go click on. It'll just give you the answer, right? And so Google sort of, you know, says this is an evolution of that, where they're in the business of helping people find information really quickly, saving them time, not making them having to go to a bunch of different websites in order to find the information that they want. And so they say, look, this is all about just helping people and connecting them to the world's information. At the same time, they're really responding to competition from other companies. So OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, when they came out with ChatGPT about a year and a half ago, a lot of people said, oh, if this thing can just answer a bunch of questions, why would I ever use Google? And Google got really scared. And they said, we need to fix this. We need to get back on top of this. And so I do think that there's probably people who work at Google who weren't necessarily on board with this change, but the company decided we need to get into the AI game. We need to start answering questions with AI because our competitors are doing that. And Wall Street doesn't like that we're not keeping up with them. And maybe if we let this moment pass us by, we won't be as big and powerful and make as much money as we do today.
Well, that could mean a lot less money for places like the Washington Post or other outlets where you don't have to click on the website anymore. You can just get this summary to your question or find out what the news is or what have you through this AI generated response.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people who make money by putting information on the internet feel that this is a bit of a bait and switch, that the rug is being pulled out from underneath them, because a lot of the reason people make content, you know, the reason someone is putting a recipe blog on, the reason someone wrote a step-by-step guide to how to fix your toilet is because Google incentivizes people to make really good content that is accurate, that, you know, helps people, and put it on the website, put it on the internet. And then when people search for that, Google finds out what is the best website that answers those questions and then sends those people traffic. And so that's the business model for a lot of people who make things for the internet, especially if they're not charging for a subscription. They want people to look for things, find them through Google, come to their website, look at an advertisement, and that's how they get paid. And so what Google's doing now is they're reading the content themselves, and they're just showing it on their website. And the people who make this stuff are really worried that now that more and more of their content is displayed directly in Google, people aren't going to be clicking through anymore. If Google gives you 8 steps to how to fix your toilet, or they tell you, you know, a complete recipe for how to make an easy weekday night chili, why would you click through and spend more time on that person's website? And that means that person won't be getting any advertising revenue. They won't be able to continue their business, and they'll have to do something else.
Ooh, okay. So this could be revolutionary, or a big earthquake, or however you want to describe it.
It is. So it's really difficult to tell, has this already started impacting people? Has this already led to traffic numbers coming down for people who have websites? Now we're really going to be able to see, because they are pushing this out this week to almost everyone in the United States. By the end of the year, Google says 1 billion people around the world, which is, you know, almost everyone who uses Google search, will be seeing these AI answers. And the tricky thing with Google is they're not transparent about this. They say, oh, don't worry, we're still going to be sending a lot of traffic. We don't want to put people out of business. That's not in our interest. And then you say to them, okay, well, can you show us some of the numbers? You've done studies. We know that they have been testing this internally, because they do that constantly. It's Google. They're very good with data and making decisions based on data. But they don't want to share that with the world. And so people are very skeptical of them. I think it's very true that Google doesn't want to put everyone who makes content for the internet out of business. Google relies on humans to make things for the internet. But they may want to take more of that pie and say, you know, we'll send you some traffic, maybe enough to keep you alive. But what we really want to do is keep people on Google.com, keep them searching more and more until they ask a question that we feel we can show them an ad that we make money for.
Well, I mean, also, they're getting the information from somewhere. It's not like the AI is making it up. They're scraping the internet. So they're using people's work to generate this information.
Yeah, I mean, they're actually using it twice in a way, because the reason the AI is smart, or appears to be smart, or is able to have conversations and answer questions is because, as you said, Google went and scraped the entire internet, every single news article that's ever been put online, every Wikipedia article, every comment that someone's made, maybe on a social media site, every blog, you know, when you were in college and you're writing a blog about your feelings, that went into this thing, and it led to this AI that can now generate language. So that's the first place where they took people's content without payment or permission. And now the way it works to get fresh content, to get stuff that is up to date, is it actually reads news articles, it reads blog posts that are new and that are fresh, and it summarizes them on its own. And so that's the two places where people feel that this was really unfair. And they want Google to start striking some deals and say, okay, we'll pay you for what we did. But from Google's perspective, they believe that, you know, it's completely fair what they did, that if something is on the public internet, it's fair game, and someone can read it and use it to make new technology.
Oh. What is the Washington Post going to do? Do you know?
You know, that's way above my head. And I'm just a meager reporter who gets to write about this stuff. I think if you look at the different things news organizations have done, there's a bit of a pattern. I mean, if you look at the New York Times, they've actually sued not Google, but Microsoft and OpenAI for scraping all their content and using it to build technology. News organizations, including the Washington Post, are also experimenting with their own AI, you know, not necessarily to write articles, but to make the lives of reporters and editors faster, to sort of come up with ideas for headlines. They don't want to be left behind. They've seen what happens when there's big technological shifts like the internet, like social media. And whenever you see these shifts, huge swaths of the news industry struggles and many, many places go bankrupt. Thousands of journalists have lost their jobs over the last 20 years as the internet has progressed into our lives. And so I think journalists, news organizations, people who run these publications, they're worried too, and they want to say, is there a way we can do this? And so it's a very interesting time and very dynamic time for the news media as they sort of respond to these changes.
Gerrit de Vink, tech reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Anytime.
Thank you for listening to us here at KCRW on Plus Play during our spring pledge drive. This is the first day of our on-air spring pledge drive. We've been engaged in a soft launch for a few days now, but this is when we really rev it up. So we want you to go right now online to kcrw.com/give and donate. If you're listening right now, you're benefiting from this service, so please invest in the mission. $20 a month, and we thank you. Public media, of course, is free for everyone. It's based in truth. It's focused on service. And that seems to be, well, as we just heard in the last segment, something under threat from all areas. So we do rely on you to help provide this service without an agenda. KCRW.com/give. Coming up, there is open revolt in the Israeli government. The defense minister calling on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to announce a plan for Gaza. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. From the moment Hamas launched the October 7th attacks, Israel has been very clear about its goal, eradicate Hamas. But what the Israeli government has not said is how Gaza should be governed after they do that, after they eradicate Hamas, or who should do it. Yesterday, Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, demanded that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu unveil a plan.
אני קורא לראש הממשלה. בנימין נתניהו, לקבל החלטה ולהכריז כי ישראל לא תשלוט אזרחית.
He says, I call on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to make a decision and declare that Israel will not have civilian rule over the Gaza Strip, that there will be no Israeli military administration in the Gaza Strip, and that a governing alternative to Hamas in the Gaza Strip will be promoted immediately. Netanyahu did not respond, at least not publicly. Meanwhile, a member of his cabinet, the far-right Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, wants Israel to reoccupy Gaza and build Jewish settlements there. Ben-Gvir is part of a far-right group of politicians Netanyahu needs to stay in power. Joining me to talk about the future of Israel, Gaza, and Netanyahu is Peter Mansour, retired U.S. Army colonel and professor of military history at The Ohio State University. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks for having me on.
So what do you make of the defense minister's comments just there and such a public display of defiance from a member of Israel's war cabinet?
Well, finally, we have a senior member of the Israeli government acknowledging the obvious that there has to be a day after the military action is complete, if indeed it ever is complete. But without a political solution, there will be essentially a forever military problem for Israel in Gaza.
So would you liken it to the United States in Afghanistan, the United States in Iraq, the United States in past conflicts like Vietnam?
I would absolutely liken it to Afghanistan and Iraq. In Afghanistan, if you recall, we wanted revenge. After 9/11, we went in to destroy the Taliban government and al-Qaeda. We kicked them out of power, and then we kind of looked around and said, okay, what's next? George Bush, in a meeting of his war cabinet before the military operations began, said, okay, so who's going to govern Afghanistan after we've destroyed the Taliban? And he got a lot of blank stares back at him from his most senior advisors. And I'm afraid this is what has happened with Israel and Gaza.
Is it something the United States has warned Netanyahu about? It said, look what happened to us. Don't make our mistakes.
The Biden administration has been warning the Netanyahu administration from day one, from October 7th, that unless it has a political plan to end the conflict, the military actions will only temporarily provide some sort of respite from Palestinian insurgency. This is essentially a political problem, and it does not have a military solution. The military actions can help move a political solution on, but there has to be one.
But could you argue that Israel knows the enemy better because it, in fact, lives right next door to it than the United States did with either Afghanistan or Iraq?
Well, this is what they claim. So in 2008, after I had retired, Israeli officials invited me to Tel Aviv to discuss what worked during the surge. During the surge, I was executive officer to General David Petraeus, the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq. And they said, okay, so what do you have for us? And I said, well, the most important thing is to find reconcilable elements of the Palestinian population and empower them and to come with some sort of common agreement on a political solution to the conflict. And they looked at me and they said, well, that won't work with the Palestinians. What else do you have for us? They were incredibly tactically focused and couldn't see the bigger picture.
And the bigger picture, as has been described by Petraeus, David Petraeus, is something called clear, hold, build. That was the philosophy that he used during the surge. So you clear the area of the militants, you hold it, and then you build it back up with the help of the residents. And so it is, but that is something that you could see then Israel enmeshed, if it holds that, does that strategy, enmeshed in Gaza for decades.
Well, not if they acknowledge that the Palestinian people need some sort of political sovereignty. This is what they're asking for. That's what they've been asking for since 1948. And this is the root cause of the problem we've got. And what Israel is very good at is clearing areas, but then they leave, and then the Hamas and other elements of the Palestinian governing authority, they reemerge. And then the Israeli forces have to go in and clear again. So they never get to the holding and building stage because they do not want to acknowledge that the Palestinians need a state of their own.
Yeah, and that is something that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been pretty clear about. And it doesn't seem like the majority of Israelis are in favor of a two-state solution either. So given the fact that that is not in the cards, at least right now, what is the next best alternative?
I'm not sure there is one. If Israeli forces leave, Hamas will reemerge. It has a fairly significant amount of support from the Palestinian people. The Arab states, I doubt, will send in peacekeeping troops unless they have Palestinian backing, which they won't, absent a political solution to the conflict. So the Israelis, I get it that they view this as an existential issue, and they've been harmed grievously by the horrific actions of October 7th. But they need to come to terms with the fact that they've got Palestinian people living on their borders, and they need to provide some sort of political solution to their needs.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said, quote, we do not support and will not support an Israeli occupation of Gaza. What can the United States do? As you pointed out, the U.S. from October 7th onward has been very clear that there needs to be a post-war plan and has not received that from Netanyahu and has received a lot of, rejection from Netanyahu in terms of its demands, Rafah, for example. So how much can the United States actually do to try to effect an effective post-war plan for Gaza when the Prime Minister doesn't seem very interested in cooperating with what the United States wants?
So that's one problem. The other problem is the Biden administration is caught between two poles in the United States. His own party is very supportive of Palestinian sovereignty, and the opposing party is very, very pro-Israel. And so whatever he does is going to be damned by one party or the other. If he wants to play real hardball, he would go to the United Nations and join many, many countries in acknowledging a Palestinian state. He could do that. He could embargo arms from Israel. That doesn't seem likely. So those are the things he can do to ramp up the pressure. But the sort of soft talking behind the scenes does not seem to be getting the job done. It almost seems like he's waiting for a new government to come into place whenever that may happen.
Right. And so who knows, because Netanyahu, as I said in the intro, really needs these far-right members of his coalition to stay in power, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's calling for Jewish settlements in Gaza. Do you think it's a possibility that that will actually happen?
I don't think it's a likelihood that there will be Jewish settlements in Gaza again. They would be under fire from day one. But this shows you that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not likely to give in to demands to create a Palestinian state on his borders, because he would lose the support of the very coalition that keeps him in power. And any sort of vote that happens in Israel now probably would bring a different government into power. And he doesn't want that either.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
I wish I had some better answers for you.
I know, don't we all? Peter Mansour, retired U.S. Army colonel and professor of military history at The Ohio State University. All right. Well, thank you for listening to KCRW on the very first day of our spring pledge drive. And we are starting strong. We have $20,000 on the line. KCRW board member Nikki Jaeger and her husband, Dan Ehrlich, are putting up this special challenge today only. Your dollars are doubled. Give now to turn $100 into $200 to fund all the news, the music, and the culture coverage you love and rely on, but only until midnight tonight. So donate right now. If you've been thinking about it and you've been putting it off, now is a great time for free money. Do it now at kcrw.com/give. And thank you. Coming up, we'll have your weekend film reviews, including the new Amy Winehouse biopic and a kids movie by John Krasinski. It's called If.
And then the score, like, I've heard happier music at a funeral.
Ooh, we got some hot takes next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. On this week's film reviews, we dive into a movie about Amy Winehouse's short but dramatic and important life. But does the biopic about her do justice to her and her legacy? That movie is Back to Black, and one of four films we'll be reviewing with Katie Walsh, who reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Katie.
Hi there.
And Sean Edwards, film critic at Fox 4 News in Kansas City and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Hi, Sean.
Hello. How are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, let's talk about Back to Black, the long-awaited biopic about Amy Winehouse, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson and features Marisa Abella as the jazz pop singer.
From primary school to sellout concerts. It's going to happen one of these days. Boys like yours got to.
Well, it's one of the best I've ever heard.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
I met someone tonight.
Stay lucky, Amy.
Got an eye for the bad boys.
All right, Sean, it's been 13 years since she died. How well or poorly does this movie do in portraying her life and what happened?
Back to Black
isn't as nearly hard-hitting or earth-shattering as the 2015 Oscar winner documentary. But that is both a good thing and a bad thing. Now, yes, the singer died at age 27 of alcohol poisoning, and she was known for having a really problematic and troubling life. And yes, the movie does a great job of capturing that. But the bad thing about that is the movie does a really poor job of really taking us in a new direction and helping us discover new elements about Amy Winehouse's life. I mean, we pretty much know, you know, the surface things about her. It's also sad because the lead played by Marisa Abuela in her first feature film is completely captivating as Amy Winehouse. I mean, she has the mannerisms. She even used her own voice when singing. That's both brave and bold, and it all worked. But unfortunately, she isn't given much else to do. But elements in dealing with her boyfriend and her dad, I mean, those were some controversial issues that happened with those two. And they kind of seem to be really glossed over and kind of like cleaned up. And the biggest flaw is, sadly, you get to see very little of the genius that went into creating her music, which is what I really wanted to see from this film.
Mm. All right, Marisa Abuela, I was like, who is that? And then I remembered she was in that HBO show Industry, and she played a totally different character. She played like an upper crust toff. So, Katie, what did you think of her performance and the movie?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so impressive that she does her own singing, which I don't think was originally the plan. But as she started kind of training to perform the songs, you know, she really captures Winehouse's sound, and she sounds great. I agree with Sean. The documentary is so much better, and I think it actually really deals with a lot of the industrial factors that led to Amy Winehouse's breakdown, the constant media scrutiny, the paparazzi, the pressure to tour and perform constantly, which was also encouraged by her father. I think her dad gets off really easy in this film. It's just a very sort of reductive, almost insultingly reductive portrait of her demons, because they ascribe everything to the toxic relationship with Blake Fielder Civil, who is played by Jack O'Connell in the film. And he's actually really good. But it's just like, she's a girl with a great voice and a bad boyfriend, and that's the end of the story. They also kind of try to put this idea that she's really sad and tormented because she hasn't had kids, which I just find really insulting. And
she's only 27.
They sanitize it, as Sean said, and they don't dig deep into the nuances. I found it to be a really like incurious and kind of condescending portrait of Amy Winehouse. And she was just such a, you know, outsized talent. And I loved her music so much, and watching her downfall was such a horror. And they just, this facsimile just like can't even come close to the real thing.
Back to Black showing in theaters beginning today. Let's shift to an entirely different film, a children's comedy called IF, or maybe IF, which stands for Imaginary Friends, the latest project from John Krasinski featuring Ryan Reynolds and a tween girl played by Kaylee Fleming. And they team up to reunite anthropomorphic imaginary friends with the kids they once helped.
We've started the matchmaking agency to help IFs find new kids.
Or we just disappear.
All right, Katie, what did you think?
You know, it's funny, the trailer makes so much more sense than the actual movie. Casting is very bizarre, but it really just feels like such a celebrity vanity project for John Krasinski. He got a whole bunch of celebrities to give voices. George Clooney, Emily Blunt, Matt Damon, all these people are voicing these imaginary friends for like one or two lines. It's just this incredibly strange, like nonsensical story about matchmaking imaginary friends back with their old kids, but then there's no stakes. Like nobody knows what happens to the imaginary friends if they don't match up with the kids, and no, there's no explanation of like who can see what or why this girl can see them. And the other very strange thing about this movie is that it is incredibly somber and sad. It is like about dead and dying parents. And oh my gosh. It doesn't, it's like very morose. And I just feel like the script is nothing. This movie is completely bizarre and makes no sense.
Sean?
I want to create some counterbalance, but I completely agree. This is a really weird movie. Clearly, the most impressive part about it is John Krasinski's contacts in his phone, because he was able to call like 3/4 of Hollywood to participate for like a millisecond. It's so like showy, like, yeah, I have cool friends and they'll drive through LA traffic to record two lines for me. But yeah, the movie makes no sense. It's part Toy Story, part Monsters, Inc., part The Sixth Sense, part Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the stop motion classic, think The Island of Misfit Toys. This will probably only appeal to 3 to 8-year-olds. And then the score, like, I've heard happier music at a funeral. It's just all like, what are we doing here? It's so sad. It's not fun. It's confusing. It seemed like it was an idea that wasn't fully formed, but they moved ahead and did the movie anyway.
If available, if you want to brave traffic in theaters beginning today. Next up, we have Gasoline Rainbow, a project from the Ross brothers, Bill and Turner Ross, that is sort of a documentary. I mean, it is a feature film, but it follows a group of recent high school grads, and I believe they're non-actors, on a road trip.
They're going to have a party at this place called the End of the World at some beach or something.
It might be fun.
Are you going? Down.
As soon as we hit that highway, felt like a new beginning was coming.
This movie follows a group of freewheeling Gen Z kids. They are on a road trip. It sounds a little like something from the 60s almost. I don't know. Sean, tell us more.
No, you're exactly right. It's just like that, except it's set in current times, 2024, and it's Gen Zers, which adds a sort of like a different perspective to the road trip movie. But yeah, it's interesting because these are like 5 high school teenagers. They're seniors. And so they're like, they're looking down the road, so to speak, at what's next for us. And, you know, what do you do when you're wondering what's next? You go on a road trip. But the beautiful thing about this movie is it actually functions like a true road trip. It's unpredictable. It's organic. It's haphazard. But it's all pretty uniquely authentic. And I think this works because it's the way that these actors who sort of play themselves are allowed to just be. This doesn't feel scripted at all, which makes it lean toward feeling like a documentary. The shots, which are beautiful, often feel as they were filmed on a cell phone. And then there's still photography that pops up that helps tell the story. Then you get bits of narration. But the thing that I really liked about this film is it's neither an examination or an indictment of Gen Zers. Like, it's just like sort of this movie that breaks all the rules of structure, because there's no beginning, there's no middle, there's no end. And basically, we're just getting a glimpse of these young adults just existing. It's almost like a hippie film, but made in 2024. But I thought that was brilliant, because somehow it does manage to avoid all the tropes that you usually see in this type of genre film.
Katie, the Ross brothers, tell us more about them. Who are they and what have they done previously?
Yeah, they're known for their documentaries. So they're a New Orleans-based filmmaking duo. They, you know, have been making documentaries for 15 years. And they made a film in 2020 called Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets that was kind of their first foray into this kind of scripted narrative blend between documentary and hybrid. They basically got a bar and selected a group of bar flies and said it's the last night of the bar, and they just filmed all of these people hanging out, talking, drinking, etc. So it was sort of like a, you know, fictional scenario but with real people. They cast these kids, they are first time actors, you could say, but they really did become friends, especially I think in the casting process. So all of their interactions are very authentic, and then the events along the road trip are, you know, sort of planned, but they just sort of let them play out and sort of captured the spontaneity, the improvisation, the conversations that were happening. So you would think it would be harrowing or scary, but I think they kind of take that away because the kids really care for each other in such a beautiful way. And so what comes through is really their bond, their friendships, and then also just their openness, their pliability as people in this brief, fleeting moment in time, and the way that they're open to meeting strangers, and the mutual aid and kindness that they get from different people that they meet on the road or that they, you know, reach out to. And there's just a real beauty in that kind of community, that collectivism. And the Ross brothers sort of dreamed up this film during quarantine in 2020. And you can see why that this was probably on their minds, because it's this craving for freedom to hit the road, to be together. It feels very specific to Gen Z, but there is a timelessness because it really makes you long for that period of time in your life that's so short, where you're not a kid and not quite an adult. You haven't been like hardened into a person yet. So it really just made me feel so nostalgic, and also just, I loved like experiencing those feelings again of freedom and possibility. I think it's a real triumph, and it's stunningly beautiful. So highly recommend this one.
Oh, fantastic. Gasoline Rainbow, available in select theaters, also streaming on Mubi at the end of the month. Last, we have Babes, a comedy about the highs, lows, and who knows what's middles of pregnancy. Ilana Glazer of Broad City fame co-writes and co-stars in the film. It's directed by Pamela Adlon.
You don't have to do anything you don't want to do.
I have your back no matter what.
You think I can do this, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Katie, this kind of looks like the pregnancy version of Bridesmaids, and I do love all the women involved in this. How did it work for you?
So I should really be the target audience for this movie. I am a white woman of a certain age. I loved Broad City when it was on, which was Ilana Glazer's show. I love Michelle Buteau, who's the comedian who co-stars as her best friend. Unfortunately, Babes did not work for me at all. It is this sort of gross out pregnancy comedy about these two friends who are supporting each other through their journeys through motherhood. Ilana Glazer plays a character who gets accidentally pregnant and decides to keep the baby and is relying on her friend who already has two kids for help. It's a gross out comedy about pregnancy, which, you know, there is a world for that, a space for that, but it just doesn't have any structure or stakes to the screenplay. The jokes are not there. I did not find it funny. I'm a little bit over the sort of like overperformed shtick that's going on here. And I just didn't find it very plausible at all. I couldn't find it relatable or interesting or funny in any way. So unfortunately, this was a flop for me.
Sounds like a no-go from Katie. Sean, what did you think?
Yeah, Babes is a weird movie because, like Katie said, I mean, yes, it would seem like she would be the target audience, but strangely, Babes felt like a movie that was written, directed, and produced by a man. I mean, it was like some of the way that they deal
with
it.
But it was
written
by a man, right? Or at least co-written, Josh Rabinowitz.
It was co-written, but not fully written. I mean, Ilana was the co-writer, so you would think that, you know, some of her perspectives would be better included in this film, because the way that they deal with pregnancy and the way that they deal with friendships between two women, it all seemed like very juvenile, and none of it seemed to be based in reality. And it was just like, you know, we got some jokes and we have some quips. Let's put this in. Let's put that in. But it doesn't really tell a full functioning story, and it doesn't really do any justice to the reality of being a woman that's out here like raising kids or about to raise a kid. It just all seemed very surface level and silly. It says a lot when a film like Knocked Up, which I didn't believe was that great, is actually a better movie about pregnancy than Babes. Job not well done on something that could have really, like, they could have really utilized this story to say something big and say something important in a really fun and hilarious way. And they just didn't. It seemed like they went the easy route on every joke. It felt like Twitter wrote this movie.
Babes is a bummer. Babes showing at AMC theaters. And that does it for this week. Sean Edwards from Fox 4 News in Kansas City and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association, and Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, it's day one of our spring on-air pledge drive. If you've never donated before, we know it feels weird to ask you to pay for something you really technically have for free, but it's not really for free. Nothing is. Hello. But, you know, there are other people who are donating to keep this service alive. So we're coming to you to ask you for your monthly support. It's really the only way this place stays up and running. There's a lot of news to keep up with. So please donate now at kcrw.com/give. Lots of great thank you gifts there when you go online, including all of our brand new merch for this spring fundraiser. Go check it out. It's super cool. Coming up, Evan Kleiman is here to show you the wonderful world of sugar, so much more than basic white or brown. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Many of us have sugar in our pantry, of course, for baking or maybe adding a little sweetness to our coffee or something savory. But there are a variety of sugars out there, and they impart different flavors depending on what you use. So for our weekly food segment, Evan Kleiman is here with a guide to some unusual sugars. She's, of course, the host of KCRW's Good Food. Hello.
Hello.
You say that when you cook and bake a lot, you become acutely aware that often, like, one tiny variation in this one ingredient, sugar, can yield a very large flavor difference. Tell us more.
Yeah, you know, I think that when you cook a lot, well, first of all, you tend to shop in a different way than a lot of people. You search out, like, oh, I wonder what this will do. You'll be in a store that has a library of sugars, and you'll see one that you haven't tried before, and you go, oh, I wonder what that would do to my X, my scone, my cookie, my curry. And you get it, and then you play with it. You know, white sugar brings sweetness to a dish, but not really any flavor. I kind of think of it as like this transparent sweetness. Hmm. But brown sugars bring sweetness, of course, but also that signature caramelized toffee-ish kind of flavor.
So any recipe that has or that calls for white sugar, you can substitute brown sugar for and have a different taste?
Pretty much, yeah. And depending upon which type of brown sugar you are playing with. And I use the word play because I think it's good for people to experiment. Like, for example, if you have a scone recipe that you use all the time, you love scones, you make them, why not use like muscovado sugar or even turbinado sugar, which is sort of maybe the least interesting, but something else than white sugar to sort of change the game a little bit, you know, enrich the canvas, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, does it change the texture of the finished product? Like if you baked a chocolate chip cookie and you didn't use any white sugar, would it change what it felt like when you ate it?
It might make it more chewy. Brown sugars tend to be very hygroscopic, which means they hold water. And so your baked goods usually last a little bit longer, and the crumb of whatever you're making can be more tender.
And you make your own brown sugar, I understand. How do you do that?
Yeah, if we're talking about just regular industrial brown sugar that all of us buy in the brown box, it is an industrialized product. So it's basically a product that's been refined and stripped of what gave it its character, and that's white sugar. To make brown sugar, they just take molasses, which is the byproduct of this refining process, and they add it back in. And so brown sugar depending on if it's light or dark sugar, varies between like around 3.5% of molasses to 6.5% for dark brown. So rather than just constantly running out of brown sugar or having it get really hard, which I find extremely annoying, I just make my own. I just pour white sugar into a bowl and I start adding molasses tablespoon by tablespoon and stirring until I get it the color that I want.
Oh, and you can use it immediately?
You can use it immediately. I usually make about 3 or 4 cups of white sugar at a time, and then I put it in a mason jar or I put it in a Ziploc bag, and it stays moist and lasts forever. So this is the way that I have found that works for me, to know that I can always have brown sugar when I need it. I'm never going to run out. And unless I go through a bottle of molasses. And who does that, really? Almost no one.
Brer Rabbit, but aside from him. What is raw sugar and how is that different to bake with?
Okay, so raw sugar is basically the lightest form of brown sugar. It is also called turbinado, and there's another variety, demerara, that has the same amount of molasses in it, but it has a different crystallized structure, so it's more crunchy. They are single instead of double crystallized natural brown sugars. And so they're very lightly brown or kind of taupe-ish. And they actually have less residual molasses than an industrial light brown sugar. Their raw sugar turbinado is about 2%.
But do you use them to bake or just as a topping?
Oh, no, totally. Well, demerara I would use as a topping. Anything that has an interesting texture I would use as a garnish. They're really great crunchy. But if you want your sugar to melt, then I would use something like turbinado or raw sugar if you want.
You recently mentioned a sugar that I'd never heard about. We talked about on the show recently. It's called Okinawan black sugar. What is that?
So the Okinawan black sugar, which is also known as kokuto, is the most complex brown sugar in flavor. It has notes of minerality. It's very high in calcium, potassium, and iron. There's a hint of smokiness and a tiny bit of bitterness, too. Some say it's the rawest sugar in the world. It comes in blocks. You can get blocks like kind of the size of a chocolate bar, or thumbprint-sized rectangles, or a smashed crumble. And it's used in both sweet and savory dishes, and you can eat chunks of it like candy.
Hmm, and it's black?
It ranges from dark brown, very dark brown, to nearly black.
Okinawan black sugar, and where would you get that?
I think Toiro here in town carries it, the Japanese houseware shop. But you can look online and find it. It's in many different stores, and you can see all the different variations of it also. I think probably one of the most useful, interesting brown sugars is Muscovado, because it's darker than turbinado or demerara, and it's more artisanally made, like the Okinawan black sugar or the Mexican piloncillo or Indian jaggery.
And what would you put it in?
Well, I would definitely kind of play with making a laddu, which is like a little round sweet that's made in India. I've given a link to a 2-ingredient laddu. I would play with making that, but it's also used to balance savory dishes, like a little pinch in a raita or a curry. Think if you want to balance a tomato sauce with sugar, right? Some people do that, put a pinch of sugar in. This kind of sugar just rounds it out.
You don't need to encourage me to eat sugar. You have several recipes on the website.
Yeah, I have 3 different kinds of cookies. You know, a Muscovado brown sugar cookie, a spicy, really interesting cookie from Nick Sharma. It's spiced with black pepper. So it's sweet from jaggery. And then it also has the black pepper. Yum. Mm. And then from Smitten Kitchen, I have a brown butter, brown sugar shortbread.
Oh my gosh. Okay. You can find links to these recipes at KCRLB.com/goodfood. Also listen to the show Good Food Saturday mornings at 10 and Please subscribe to the Good Food newsletter and the podcast at ksrlb.com/goodfood. Evan, what's on the show this week?
So Good Food this week, we talked to Memo Torres. He's a journalist who writes for LA Taco, but he also does these monthly picks for Apple Maps, where he picks 5 under the radar restaurants. Always so interesting to talk to him. And I also talked to Olga Masov and Sinai Lemoine, who have written a really great cookbook on using the sheet pan.
Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening to KCRW on the very first day of our spring pledge drive. We're starting strong with $20,000 on the line. One of our board members named Nikki Jaeger and her husband, Dan Ehrlich, are putting up a special challenge today only. Your dollars are doubled. Give now to turn $100 into $200 to fund the great music, news, and culture coverage that you love and rely on. Only until midnight tonight. Donate right now at kcrw.com/give. And thank you and treat yourself, because there are lots of great thank you gifts at that website, lots of cool merch and lots of ways to give back either through the food banks or through any other opportunities there. So go on kcrw.com/give and start off strong. Help us win this spring pledge drive. So you can do it. kcrw.com/give. Our producers are Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Nihar Patel, Zeke Reed, and Eddie Sun, Brian Hardzinski, and Rebecca Haggerty were our line editors this week. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our fabulous managing producer, and our technical director is Super Mario Saavedra. Michael Stark and Phil Richards engineered too. Whew, lots of people this week. I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you for listening, and tune in tomorrow for KCRW's Left, Right, and Center here, noon and 7 on 89.9 KCRW. I'll see you on Monday.